Aloha! You are listening to Inside the Desert Oasis Room, episode number 50. This episode is sponsored by Tanduay Rum. Established in the Philippines in 1854, Tanduay is the world's largest rum producer and winner of over 170 international medals in the past four decades, including Brand of the Year in London's World Branding Awards Rum category from 2015 to 2017 and Rum Brand Champion of the World by thespiritsbusiness.com in 2015. As sponsor of the Inside the Desert Oasis Room podcast and the toast to Master Ninja Ray Buen at the legendary Tiki Tea in Los Angeles, California, Tanduay Rum is the perfect companion to celebrate all things tiki. For more information, check out their webpage at tanduayus.com or follow them on Facebook or Instagram at tanduayusa. This podcast is also sponsored in part by the Royal Hawaiian. Founded in Laguna Beach, California in 1947, the Royal Hawaiian is South Orange County's premier tropical drink and dining destination. Come try their signature cocktail, the Lapu Lapu, a delicious combination of tropical fruit juices with a generous float of dark spirits, or other island-inspired favorites like ahi tuna poke or the dynamite crab-crusted mahi mahi. Enjoy their delicious brunch or drop in for happy hour from 2:30 to 5:30 p.m. daily for drink specials and more. To make a reservation, visit RoyalHawaiianLB.com. On today's episode, we chat with Jeff Beachbum Berry. Jeff is a fixture in the tiki and craft cocktail community, and he's the author of The Groglog, Intoxica, Remix, Sippin' Safari, Taboo Table, and Potions of the Caribbean. And he's close to releasing a new book celebrating the 10-year anniversary of Sippin' Safari. Jeff shares with us a wealth of history in both tiki and cocktails, and even answers a few questions provided by our listeners. These are the kind of episodes that I really enjoy putting together for you guys. And if you enjoyed listening to it, help us out by going to DesertOasisRoom.com and clicking on the donate button. This podcast is a grassroots effort, and it only survives through the help of our sponsors and our listeners. Any donation, no matter how small, helps keep the show coming to you every week. Okay, here he is, the one and only, Jeff Beachbum Berry. Alrighty. Hey, Jeff.
Aloha.
Thanks for joining me today.
My pleasure. Happy to be here.
I got to tell you, I'm really excited about having you on the podcast. And as I'm sure our listeners are, we have lots of questions for you. And what I really like to always ask people, because knowing what they do today, one of the things that always interests me is what they did before who they are today. So before we get into that, for our listeners out there that don't know, and if you don't know, you should be ashamed of yourself. Jeff Berry is the author of The Groglog and Intoxica and Remixed and Sippin' Safari and Taboo Table. And am I missing anything else?
Potions of the Caribbean.
Potions of the Caribbean. I have all of these books, by the way, and I'm actually afraid to use them because I don't want to mess them up.
Oh, you need a library copy and a bar copy.
I do. You know, in the early days of the Groglog, I remember people taking them down to a Kinko's and getting the pages laminated. Did you hear about that?
Yeah.
So they were having them laminated and spiral bound, and I think I have an extra copy that I need to do that with, but it's so perfect that I don't even want to do that. But
okay.
But anyway, so as a cocktail authority and a rum authority, I know that's not what you always did. What did you do before you were doing what you do today? Before Latitude 29 and before Groglog and all the tiki stuff?
Well, I didn't want to be Trader Vic. I wanted to be Stanley Kubrick. I went to film school at UCLA, and when I got out in 1980, fell into film advertising. I used to write trailers and movie poster ads and all that, and eventually broke into Hollywood and was a screenwriter for about 8 years. Had a pretty good run doing a lot of uncredited rewrites. And doing my own short films the whole time, and eventually directing an ABC TV movie for Wonderful World of Disney back around 2000. And that was basically it. And movies were the thing. Drinks and tiki was my hobby. That was sort of what I did for fun.
Yeah, yeah. So you've been doing the tiki thing and the cocktail thing for a long time. How far back? Early 80s? Mid 80s?
Well, if you want to go all the way back, I was about 6 years old, maybe.
Oh, wow. Okay.
This would have been around 1964. My mom and dad, being from the Bronx and Brooklyn in New York, liked Chinese food. You know, it's food of my people, Chinese food.
Of course.
And they would go to any Chinese place that, you know, reminded them of New York style Chinese food. And one of those places, like old school Cantonese, was called Ah Fong's. It was on Ventura Boulevard in Encino. Later became a Mexican restaurant called Marek's, and I don't know what it is now. But back in mid-60s, it was Ah Fong's. And the reason it was Ah Fong's was because the original restaurant there, which opened in the early 60s, had spent so much money on decor that they could not recoup their costs, and they went broke almost immediately. And the place was called the Bora Bora Room.
Oh, wow. That sounds interesting.
It was amazing. And what Ah Fong's did, Benson Fong, he was an actor who became a restaurateur. He had like five Ah Fong's. And he moved an Ah Fong's into this perfectly mothballed Bora Bora Room interior, which was beautiful. It had an indoor waterfall, a lagoon, just amazing tikis. And it had like a island print carpet. Nothing was left undecorated.
Right,
it was amazing.
Right.
And he just like hermit crabbed in there, you know, and started serving Ah Fong's food. So my parents went, and it just became a place that we went regularly just because they liked the food. And I just fell in love with the room, and I wanted to live there.
Yeah.
And that was my first exposure to the Polynesian pop style. And it was like, it out-Disney. It was just like amazing. So you take this place, and you walk through the bar on your way to the dining room. Of course, I was too young to be in the bar, and my parents didn't really drink. But on the way through the bar, you could see the back bar. And the back bar, instead of having bottles, had a dawn-to-dusk diorama. The lighting would change from like sunrise to sunset of a little island scene. And the ocean would be of this resin, plastic blue. And then there was sand. And then they had a little miniature island hut and some like miniature palm trees they probably got from like a model train shop or something. And then there was like the backdrop of the changing sky. And it was just amazing, you know.
Yeah.
It's like, this is what a bar can be. And of course, when I got old enough to drink in 1979, this was the kind of place I wanted to drink in.
Yeah.
So that's kind of what started me off. You can blame Benson Fong for my lifelong obsession.
What is there today? Do you know?
I don't. You know, it'd be fun to drive by there and see what's going on.
Yeah.
You know, it's right. It was right next to the Gelson's in Encino. I don't know if that's still there.
Okay. Is the address documented somewhere online?
Oh, yeah. It's in my new book.
Oh, great. Okay. We'll talk about that, too.
Sure.
I mean, like, I'd love to hear what your projects are.
Well, it's fun that you're asking me that question straight off, because the new book that's coming out sometime this year, you know, definitely in time for the holidays, is the 10th anniversary edition of Sippin' Safari. It's been 10 years. I can't believe it. But when that book came out in 07, there was no tiki cocktail revival. There was, you know, there was a poly pop culture revival,
sure,
but you couldn't find neo tiki bars serving craft cocktails in a tiki manner. It just didn't happen. So I could have predicted this great tiki renaissance we're living in, this great tiki cocktail renaissance we're living in now. So it was a nice time in the 10th anniversary to take another look at the book. And I wrote a long 40-page afterword to the new edition, which talks about the renaissance and all these bars that opened up after the book came out. And I interviewed all the owners and said, they told me how the book, if it did influence them, how it influenced them. And I talked to guys from Italy and London and San Francisco, Chicago, like all over the place, and got recipes from them for the back end of the thing. And front end, the preface, is kind of a prequel. It talks about what I just told you, starting off with Ah Fong's, about what led up to the writing of Sippin' Safari, the whole thing about how I got into tiki and how I met everybody else who's into tiki and how it became kind of the SoCal thing in the 90s and all that.
Now, did you always lean towards the cocktail side of the tiki world, culture, subculture?
That's a great question, Adrian. I did not.
You did not? Okay.
I did not. I was a tiki file, straight up tiki file, the way that, I mean, I thought at the time I was the only one in the world, because this was
Yeah, we all did. I did too.
Yeah.
Yeah. This is before the internet. I mean, I had no idea that anybody else was into this stuff. But I loved the look. I loved the architecture. I loved the interior design. I loved the furniture. I loved the shirts. I loved the music. I loved everything about it. Cocktails, I mean, I didn't know how to make drinks. You know, I just would order them in the, I would order them in tiki bars the same way everybody else did.
Right.
I had no idea what was in them or how to make them. But that the drinks were just what you ordered inside these interiors that I love so much, you know. I mean, I'm kind of getting ahead of myself, but when I finally started to meet other tiki fellows in the 90s, and we all started, all through Sven Kirsten, who we need to talk about, because he was the prime mover in getting us all together and and discovering all the stuff that was there to be discovered in thrift stores and swap meets and
yeah,
all that.
Yeah.
But gradually, all the other tiki fellows I met sort of like ended up specializing in something. You know, like Sven ended up specializing in architecture and design, and I ended up specializing in cocktails just because I like to drink and I like to find old menus at swap meets, you know, so one thing led to another. And, you know, Bosco ended up specializing in carving and mug making.
And mug making, yeah, he was an artist.
Yeah, and other people ended up getting more into the paintings or more into the music, you know, other people started doing tiki music again.
Now, with the cocktails, did this happen by accident? Like, were you just, you were collecting the recipes and then before you knew it, you had 100 recipes or something? Or was there... Was there a focus to do that intentionally? Because I know that the original Grog Log was just a Xerox copied booklet that was stapled. Was that just you compiling them as you know on the side, and then you just realized you had enough to start handing out?
Yeah, it didn't start off being deliberate at all. I would go to first time I went to the Tiki Tea was 79. That was probably the first great tiki drink I had was Ray's Mistake at the Tiki Tea. And then, even though I didn't have the money, I would go and scrape together some laundry money and go to Trader Vic's and have one drink.
You know?
And that was spectacular. And there were other places like Kowloon, which I believe was on Pico. And Kowloon had Navy Grogs with the ice cone, and it was in a cool bar with like lava rock behind it.
Is this the same Kowloon that's in the Boston area?
No, this is in Pico Boulevard, Mid-City.
Yeah,
LA.
Okay, I didn't know about that one.
It was on its last legs when I started going in the 80s with my buddy Mike, but we discovered, hey, drinks are great. And gradually I realized the Navy Grog was my jam, you know, because there were great Navy Grogs at Kowloon. There were great Navy Grogs at Bamboo Terrace in Burbank, a little place. No longer with us. And of course, the Trader Vic's Navy Grog was like my favorite. So in the 80s, which was the cocktail dark ages, you know, nobody was doing drinks right in the 80s of any kind. You know, it was cocktail culture was dead. You go anywhere, even a very expensive restaurant where you drop $80-$100 for dinner, you're still going to get a shitty drink. You know, you're going to get, if you ordered a daiquiri, it was going to come in a hurricane glass with strawberries blended into it, and it was going to have whipped cream on the top. And if you order an old fashioned, it was going to have like three cherries and an orange muddled in it, and then they put soda in it. I had no idea what a real pre-prohibition cocktail was because I never got one. I remember there was a place called DC3 in the Santa Monica airport, which had a big splash opening.
DC3, I know that.
Yeah, big splash opening. My girlfriend at the time, now my wife, Anine, and I went there, and they had a cocktail bar, and it looked really cool. So we sat at the bar before we ate, and I ordered a martini. And the guy, like, poured gin into a shaker and shook it up and poured it into a glass. It was basically just cold gin. So you couldn't get a good, decent drink anywhere, with a couple of notable exceptions. People listening to this of a certain age who grew up in L.A., well, you know, the margaritas were always great at El Cholo and El Chavo.
Yeah.
There you use fresh lime and all that. And you could always get a good drink at Mousson Frank.
Right.
You know, we get some, like, 75-year-old white-jacketed bartender who, like, glare at you, like, what are you doing in here, kid? But he'd still give you a good sidecar, you know. But it was mostly in tiki bars, the ones that were left, that I was getting good. I was getting craft cocktails. They just weren't called craft cocktails. These were drinks with fresh juices, syrups they were making in-house, you know, premium rums. They were just doing what they always did. It wasn't any new revolutionary thing. It was just they'd never stopped doing it. Well, everybody else stopped making good cocktails, you know, different kinds.
Now, you gathered... Do you know how many recipes you've gathered over the years?
Bad ones, around 300.
Oh, really?
Yeah, good ones, the ones that I published. So, actually, by now it's got to be over 200 recipes that I've published. It's probably more like 400 or 500 bad recipes by now.
What was that effort like? I mean, because I know some of these recipes were secret.
Yeah, well, the word effort is maybe misplaced.
Okay.
Because it just was fun. It was my hobby.
Oh,
you know, but,
because it just seems like, as somebody, I'm a tiki guy. I've got a tiki mug collection.
Yeah.
And sometimes there is effort put into chasing after holy grails, right?
Yeah. Lust might be a better word than effort.
Okay, okay.
just pure naked lust for a mug or a recipe. But to answer your previous question about how I came to do the recipes, I was just going to these bars, I was drinking these drinks, that was what I did in my time off, you know, and that's how I procrastinated as well, and I just really liked them, and it was fun for me as a hobby, but I never in a million years could make a drink. I could not make, I could barely make coffee, you know.
Right.
And it was only when the bars started to disappear in the mid-80s, I thought, all right, let me go find some books and figure out how to make these drinks. And then I found out that there were no books, that most of these recipes had never been published, with the notable exception of Trader Vic, who published his recipes. None of the stuff I was drinking at Kowloon, Bamboo Terrace, Trader Vic's exception, Tiki Tea, you could not get recipes to any of these drinks. I knew the names because I had been collecting menus and I'd seen them on the Tiki Tea menu or on the Kowloon menu. Drinks like Rum Barrel, Navy Grog, Nui Nui, Never Say Die. I mean, these were all really mysterious, unknowable things. But nobody at the bar was going to tell you what was in them.
That's what I mean. It's like, how hard was it for you to get someone to talk?
Impossible. But again, I'm getting ahead of myself. But let's go back to the mid-80s when I thought, all right, let me try and learn how to make these drinks. Couldn't. There were recipes out there, but they were just bad recipes.
Okay.
Like Mr. Boston's Original Bartender's Guide had a few, and they all sucked. But nothing was published except Trader Vic's, you know, which was a good start. But he didn't have any of the great Don the Beachcomber recipes, which were the foundation of every tiki bar was Don the Beachcomber's. It wasn't Trader Vic's. Yeah, they all had a Mai Tai, a Scorpion, and a Fog Cutter, Trader Vic's three greatest hits. But Don made 70 original drinks, which formed the template for the menus of hundreds of places across the country. And whenever I went into a tiki place that existed, it was Don's drinks that I was seeing the names of. And they were unknowable. The bartenders would not tell you what was in them because they were trade secrets. They were very valuable trade secrets.
Yeah, yeah.
Which is one of the reasons why Don never published his drinks, because people would rip them off. I mean, and he would lose market share.
What about the Don recipes that Phoebe published?
She didn't do that until, 2002, I think?
Was it that late?
I'm going back to 1986, 1987.
Yeah.
So when I first started getting into it, again, purely as a hobbyist, I was collecting tiki mugs. Let's see if I can figure out what goes in them. And I realized, nobody at the bars is going to tell me what was in it. Whenever I asked Ray Bowen, hey, Ray, what's in this drink? Rum and fruit juice.
Right.
You know, I was like, well, what about this drink? Rum and fruit juice. It's like, all right, I get the message. See where this is going. And it was like that everywhere else.
Yeah.
You know? It was like nobody was going to tell me anything because that was ingrained in them over decades. It's like, these are valuable recipes, and you do not give them out because then other people will make them, and people will go to their bars. I ran into this like secrecy thing. And as someone who did some journalism in addition to the movie stuff and did some reporting, I just started putting on my reporter's shoes and, you know, went to the library and looked at the periodical index and dug up old magazines and old trade papers and, old menus sometimes libraries had, you know, old restaurant menus. And, of course, I was all the time going to used bookstores, yard sales, swap meets, all the stuff that we all did, thrift stores, looking for tiki stuff.
Yeah.
And, back then you could find menus that people had stolen as souvenirs back in the day. So I was putting together just purely ad hoc this database of this stack of menus, and I noticed that all the drinks, no matter what the place was, whether it was called the Luau or whether it was called, Langerman's or whatever it was, whatever the restaurant was, whether it was in Canada or Tennessee or San Francisco, the drink names were all pretty much the same. They were all taken from one place. And gradually, when I started getting some more Don the Beachcomber menus, it became plain to us, because there was just more than me at that point looking into this stuff, that Don was like Johnny Tiki Seed. Mm-hmm. Like, he was the big bang. Like, these were all his recipes that everybody was copying. They changed the names a little bit, which is one of the things I go into in the 10th anniversary book. For example, A Missionary's Downfall, if you ordered one at Bali High at the Beach in New Orleans, they call it the Padre's Pitfall.
Oh, interesting.
And if you ordered A Missionary's Downfall in the Lanai outside of San Francisco in the Bay Area, they called it Franciscan's Downfall. There's a place in Kansas City that called it the Missionary's Mistake, because they didn't want to think about a reverend falling from grace too much. There was a great one, a tiki place in Torrance, name escapes me right now. They called it the Apostles' Breakdown. You know, kind of Tennessee Williams of Sturm and Drang kind of thing.
Is that Latitude 20?
No, it was another one. Polynesian.
Okay.
It's called the Polynesian. Okay. I had a picture of the menu in my head. So the names would change a little bit to avoid Don's lawyers, because he would sue people. He did sue the Bali High.
Oh, he did? Oh, yeah. Okay.
He sued the Bali High. He sued a place in Manhattan called the Beachcomber, Monty Prosser's Beachcomber. Monty Prosser was claiming that he invented Don's signature drink, the zombie.
Yeah.
Called his place the home of the zombie. His logo type was the exact same as the Beachcombers.
Wow.
And he would tell customers in Manhattan, hey, when you're out in Hollywood, go to our place and there and see Don and Sonny. So Don dropped the hammer on that one. He sued. How else could he protect his recipes from being ripped off? Well, they were being ripped off by bartenders who worked for him getting poached, hired away to other places.
But he was famous for using unmarked bottles.
Well, that's what he did to stop that.
Oh, so that came later because of the... Yeah,
first what came is Ray... I mean, Ray Boone is probably the most famous example. I mean, Ray, after he left the Beachcomber to go work for the Seven Seas, because they were paying $40 a week instead of $25, he took his recipes with him. And he knew all Don's top secret recipes, and he started serving them at the Seven Seas. And then he went to the tropics and started doing that. And so he was spreading his recipes all over. And there were other bartenders like him doing that. And Don, to put a stop to it, as you say, put his recipes in code.
Yeah.
So if you're a new hire at Don's, Don says, I'm going to hire Adrian to be my bar back and train him to be a bartender. If you do get the recipes, you're going to get them in code.
Sure.
For example, instead of a half an ounce of passion fruit syrup, it'll say a half an ounce of Marquesa. There'll be things like Syrup Parisienne or Don's Mix or Spices Number 2 or Dashes Number 8. And that's what the recipe would say. And you would make the drink by taking a bottle off the shelf that had Number 8 on the label or had Marquesa on the label. And you had no idea what was in them. So if the Seven Seas hired you away... Say, hey, Adrian, we're going to pay you some more money. Come and make these drinks for us. It's cool.
Could
you
make
go
them.
Over there. Yeah, where's your number 8? Where's your number 4?
I got
nothing. And it worked. It worked really well, and it stopped the flow. And the only people who still could spread Don's recipes around were the old school ones, the OGs who knew the recipes.
Right.
I talked to a Filipino guy who worked at the Luau, Ray Barrientos. And when he got hired out of, he graduated from UCLA, his uncle, Vincent Pojas, another Filipino guy, hired him to work as a busboy, and then gradually as a barback, and then gradually as a bartender. He was the nephew of Vincent Pojas.
Mm-hmm.
They were family, and he was working in the Luau. Vincent would not give him the recipes for 6 solid months.
And he was the nephew.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, so I mean, they held these things very close. Because this was, what you have to remember is this is a passport to employment.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
If you knew these recipes, you were very hireable. Another Filipino tiki bartender, Bob Esmino, who worked at the Contiki chain, told me that very often restaurateurs like Steve Crane would hire Filipino bartenders who knew these recipes, had their little black book in their shirt pocket, this little code key, this grimoire.
Mm-hmm.
He would hire them to make the drinks, and the deal was that the bartender was not going to tell him what was in the drinks.
It's oh, like, wow. That's a good deal.
I'll tell you what to go shop for. I'll give you the I'll give you the checklist of ingredients that you need to get from Sysco or wherever. And, you know, you can I'll name the drinks and put them on your menu, pretty picture, and I'll make them. But if I don't like it here, or if I get a better offer, I'm going to leave and I'm going to take my recipes with me. And they did that.
That's pretty cool.
That's power. And I don't think any bartender has that kind of power today.
No, not at all.
So that's how valuable these recipes were.
Wow, that's really interesting. I didn't know that.
Yeah, some bartenders had 40-year careers going from place to place based on their secret knowledge of these recipes.
So... I have all kinds of questions now based on what you just said. You know, like people were taking credit for a lot of the old drinks. The famous one is the Mai Tai.
Yeah.
Now, you had written a chapter in Remixed. You put the evidence out for who could have possibly invented the Mai Tai, the debate of all ages, right? And based on the evidence you presented, I think that Trader Vic stole the recipe, or not stole the recipe, but tried to steal a drink from Don and called it the Mai Tai, based on the evidence that you presented.
Three different people have made that case, and two of them knew Don and worked for Don. One of them knew Don very well and worked for Don for 10 years. That was Mick Brownlee, his tiki carver in Waikiki, who carved all the tikis in International Marketplace. The other was a journalist, I believe his name was Rick Carroll, a journalist based in Hawaii, who Don told this story to, the same story that he told to Mick Brownlee. And the third person was Don himself, you know, who alluded to it in interviews. So two guys, one of whom was face-to-face, interviewed him. Another one was his friend and worked for him for 10 years. And then Don himself is on record as saying this. And their story is, and it never varied, it was the same story told each same way each time, was that Vic went to Don the Beachcombers in 1937, which was how he got the idea to turn his place from Hinky Dink's Barbecue Shack into Trader Vic's, and himself from Victor Bergeron into Trader Vic Bergeron. He decided to go tiki based on a week spent at Don the Beachcombers and seeing the land office business he was doing. And I was like, all right, I'm going to go Polynesian too. And according to Mick Brownlee, what Don told Mick was that Vic had really liked a drink there called the QB Cooler. And according to Don, that's the drink that Vic took back with him to Oakland and created the Mai Tai based off of that.
Right.
Now, what is left unsaid is, did he manage to wrangle the actual recipe, or did he go home and then try to recreate the taste based on what he sampled? I think it's the latter.
Yes, that would make the most sense.
Yeah. Because let's not forget, Vic was a culinary genius in his own right. Vic was the first great celebrity chef, became a multimillionaire based on his original recipes.
And
what he did for food in the U.S. was, you know, James Beard and Julia Child both said that he, like, Ruth Reichel, they all give him credit for internationalizing American cuisine. One wine writer who edited all of his cookbooks, Shirley Sarvis, told me that she thought Vic had the greatest palate of anyone she'd ever met in the wine world or in the food world.
Wow.
So here was a guy who was capable of trying a drink and reverse engineering. So that makes sense to me. Like, the QB Cooler could very well have been his inspiration when he went back up to Oakland and said, all right, let me try and recreate the drink. And there are similarities in taste between the 1937 QB Cooler recipe, which I obtained from another Filipino guy's notebook, Richard Santiago, through the good graces of his daughter Jennifer, gave me a Xerox copy of his entire notebook.
Wow.
That QB Cooler recipe from 37, the same year that Vic was at Don's, the same year he would have tried the QB Cooler, that recipe, when you make it the way it's in the book, tastes a lot like a Mai Tai.
Yeah.
But here's where Vic's genius comes into play. At the end of the day, when you make a QB Cooler and then you make Vic's Mai Tai recipe, the two drinks have nothing in common except lime juice and rum, and not even the same rum. Okay. So Don made like one of his typical 8-10, I forget how many ingredients there are, but there could be anywhere from 8 to 12 ingredients in Don's drink. all kinds of stuff, and it's flash blended in the way that he always did, with a little bit of crushed ice, the way they do with the Tiki Tiki. And Vic's drink is hand-shaken, and the only ingredients in it is basically an improved rum sour. It's lime, curacao, and this 17-year Jamaican rum, and simple syrup. Now, what's that? That's basically a rum margarita, okay? Nice, basic, simple rum sour. The genius was the orgeat syrup, a little bit of almond that he put in there, which just transforms the drink and makes it so memorable.
And it's such a small amount, too.
Yes,
it's
exactly.
A quarter ounce. A
trace amount.
It's almost like it doesn't make a difference, but it does.
Oh, but it does.
Yeah.
And that very simple, very elemental drink, you compare that to the Cuban Cooler, and you go, now, whatever the process Vic went through mentally to arrive at his recipe, by the time he got there, that's his recipe.
Okay.
You know, that's Vic's recipe. You got to give it to Vic. That is a Trader Vic drink.
Okay.
Whenever any of us makes a recipe, it's always based on something. You know, nothing comes out of thin air. You know,
sure.
You're always saying, oh, I like that. Let me see if I can use that to riff on that, you know. We all riff on stuff. Nobody can invent stuff whole from Zeus's thigh.
Yeah.
Know? So I got to give it to Vic on that one. But I also have to respect Don's story that that was the genesis of the drink.
Okay.
You know, the Cuby Cooler.
So now, this recipe for the Cuby Cooler, the one that was in the book, do you think that that came from Don's bartender or from Don himself?
Oh, you're getting into the question of did he or didn't he invent all his drinks?
Yes. You know, okay. So you know where I'm good point going. So because I've always argued that a bar owner runs the business and the bartender develops the drinks. You know, you see that time and time again in the culinary world. It's the chef who creates the plates, and it's the restaurateur who runs the business. How much of the drinks that Don is famous for came from Don himself, and how much do you think came from his bartenders?
That's an excellent question. It's also a really loaded question.
Okay.
You have to remember that Don was no longer associated with the mainland restaurants after World War II, you know, when he split for Hawaii. And
this is when he sold the business to his ex-wife at the time?
Sonny. He and Sonny, who were business partners in the first Don the Beachcombers in Hollywood, and then also one in Chicago in 1941, Don went off to fight the Second World War. When he came back, you know, he found out that Don the Beachcomber was being run perfectly well without Don the Beachcomber. And it was like, and he had nothing to do but be a figurehead. And so, well, I sold the naming rights to Sonny. Sonny has the rights to call a restaurant Don the Beachcombers in the United States. I don't. But Hawaii isn't a state. Hawaii's a territory. So he lit out for Hawaii, where he could open a Don the Beachcombers, which is what he did. And for the rest of his life, that was his base of operations. And that's Don the Beachcombers, run by Don Beachcomber. Now, in the States, if they did any menu development after Don left, and they did, then those drinks had to be developed by bartenders, because Sonny Sun was no mixologist.
Right.
What we're forgetting when we say that, you know, the bartenders develop the recipes and the restaurateur doesn't, is Don and Vic were bartenders.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, Don and Vic were mixologists, and they were mixologists who opened restaurants. They weren't restaurateurs who hired a chef and hired a mixologist to do drinks. And Don the Beachcomber started out as a bar. And then gradually they had to add food. Trader Vic's, you know, Hinky Dink started out mostly as a bar. And he was behind the bar, you know, mixing drinks. These guys were the creative driving force for the drink menus. And Vic was till the end of his days. He had very tight control over the menus of all their restaurants. And Don, in the beginning, I'm convinced, having seen a drink recipe book of Don's drinks as early as 1937, and then I have another one from 1955, courtesy of the family of another Filipino bartender who worked at the Don's in Palm Springs, and then I have a third one by him from 1972, and you look at all three of them, and you see the thread. I mean, the recipe has evolved, but Don was the big bang. Don originated this kind of drink. I think you have to give it to Don. I think that Don's canon, the basic drinks that everybody ripped off around the country for 40 years, I think those are Don's drinks.
Okay.
Now, having said that, what you say is absolutely right. Don wasn't always there. I mean, Don, after the 40s, Sonny Sun owned Don the Beachcombers. They were expanding into different cities. The menu had to evolve for various reasons that menus evolve. And who could she turn to? She could turn to the bartenders who knew the drinks, who were talented guys in their own
right.
Sure,
yeah.
You know, and you look at guys like Popo Galsini, who invented award-winning drinks. He won World IBA Bartending Championship Awards in Mallorca, Spain for his original tiki drinks. He was coming up with his own drinks, and he was a bartender. He wasn't an owner. He worked for restaurateurs. Tony Ramos came up with his own drinks. Bob Ismino came up with his own drinks, all based on what they learned during their apprenticeship at tiki places. But these were all guys who were familiar with tropical mixology, and they were coming up with their own riffs. The question is, the big question, which I don't have an answer for, but I have a theory, is how much of Don's original canon, how much of that first stuff was his? And the style is very much unified.
Okay.
In the 1937 recipe guide, there's a definite style of how Don liked to construct a drink and what he was doing.
Based on that, then, it appears that he did invent all of those drinks himself.
You know, let's throw a big, giant bamboo wrench into the whole thing.
Okay.
Which when Ray Bouin, when I interviewed him in 1998, and when I say interviewed, I was drinking one of his drinks at the Tiki Tea, and he was on the other bar, and I was writing down what he said on a matchbook cover. But it was a direct quote. I got several direct quotes from him. And he wasn't a very talkative fellow.
Yeah.
At least not to me. But he said, you know, Don was a nice guy. And this is a direct quote. Don was a nice guy, but he didn't invent any of his drinks.
You know,
he was a showman, but he didn't invent his drinks. We all did.
Now, I read when you wrote that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think that Ray was just as guilty of tiki ballyhoo as Don and Vic were.
Oh, okay.
I think that, you know, I don't know. I love the guy. I respect the guy. I have no way to contradict him with hard evidence, but I have to think he was pulling my leg. You know,
yeah,
it's like,
yeah.
If not doing that, then he was maybe getting at a truth that might have been something that splits us down the middle.
Yeah.
You know, maybe Don invented 10, 15 drinks on his menu, and maybe his bartenders started inventing other ones as he got more busy and became a mogul. Like in 1933 to 1937, when he had his little 40-seat bar in McCadden Place, it was just him,
Okay.
And him and his barbacks. He probably was inventing all his drinks over that during that time. And by the time Chicago opens in 41, he's a restaurateur with two properties in two different states. And take it from me, you don't have time to invent your own drinks
sure.
once you're doing that. You know,
no.
You're doing other stuff. Now, another thing, just to complicate matters further. On one side, you have Ray Bouin said Don was a great guy, but he didn't invent his drinks. On the other side, you have another Filipino who worked for Don for many, many, many years, whose name escapes me because I'm old and the neurons aren't firing. But he was quoted by Jane and Michael Stern in one of their books as saying Don would sit with his cronies and test like a mad scientist.
Right.
And he did that throughout his career.
Yeah.
He was always inventing. He was always changing his recipes. He was always innovating. And it always came from the top. So you had his major domo saying that. And then you had Ray, who left Don fairly early on in the game.
Right.
And had his own bar and his own quotes that he had to do to stay timely, you know. Truth maybe is in the middle. I don't know. But
it's probably in the middle. I mean, that's what makes the most sense. What motivated me to ask that question is, and I've talked with you about this before, I have a theory on the Lapu-Lapu. Now, Chief Lapu-Lapu, for those that don't know, is the Filipino... he was a Filipino warrior. And either he or him and his army slaughtered Magellan when Magellan invaded the Philippines.
Good for him.
So my theory is this. If the bartenders were Filipino, then it makes sense that a drink would be named in Chief Lapu-Lapu's honor. And if it was invented by someone else, it doesn't make sense to me, at least not, you know, logically, that they would name it after a Filipino warrior, a Filipino hero. So just that alone, and it's a theory of mine, it's not solid evidence, it makes me wonder, you know, okay, well, look, if this drink is being named after a Filipino hero, then doesn't it point to the bartenders making the drinks?
Let's get a couple things out of the way right away. All of the great tiki bartenders of the Golden Age were Filipino. Mm-hmm. Every single one of them, with the exception of Victor Bergeron, you know, who was French Canadian. But you look at Mariano Liquidine at the Maikai, the Black Magic and the Mutiny were his original creations, and those are some of the greatest tiki drinks ever made.
Black Magic is such a great drink.
Yeah, and he created many other drinks for them as well. These guys were talented mixologists in their own right, but they were riffing on stuff they learned apprenticing at Don the Beachcombers or with sure. other people who worked for Don at different places. So you've got to give the Filipino bartending community major props for basically running the machine, keeping it happening, and creating and making the second wave creations. I think from the 1950s on, you can pretty much rest assured that whatever new drink came along was invented by a Filipino bartender who had whatever amount of experience and training at during the first wave.
Mm-hmm.
Mariano's a perfect example. Went to work for Don in 39, worked at Don's in Chicago. For years yeah. and years and years, cut his teeth there, and by 1956 he was ready to start creating his own drinks in that
and
style.
He was the guy who created the drinks for the Maikai.
Right. Now let's talk about the Lapu Lapu. I agree with you, Adrian. I think the Lapu Lapu almost certainly was invented by a Filipino bartender. It did not appear on any menus I've ever seen before the mid-1950s. So it was obviously a second wave creation, 1950s post-war tiki drink, at a time when all the great tiki restaurateurs were not creating drinks anymore. Trader Vic had already created all of his greatest drinks by then. Don the Beachcomber was basically just still refining all of his greatest creations that he had done in the 30s and 40s off in Hawaii. And the people who were creating new drinks for restaurants that they worked for were the Filipino bartenders. My take on it is exactly the same as yours. I think somewhere in the 1950s at some tiki restaurant, some Filipino bartender invented mm-hmm. the Lapu Lapu, mm-hmm. and it just started spreading virally the way these things did. And sooner or later, almost every restaurant had a Lapu Lapu on its menu. We don't know who this guy was, and we know he's a guy because of the extreme sexism back then. You didn't have lady bartenders back right, then in tiki right. places. You know, Jennifer Santiago, who gave me her dad Richard's recipe, said that she wanted to be a bartender, and her dad said, no way. You know, it's like, it's not going to happen.
Yeah.
And that would have been 1960s probably.
Yeah.
Yeah, the Lapu Lapu would make perfect sense. Like, who would name a drink after a great Filipino hero? A Filipino.
That's what seems logical to me.
This episode is sponsored in part by Steadfast Pomade. Steadfast Pomade is a strong-holding, medium-bodied, water-based styling product for men and women, which leaves your hair looking slick, neat, and shiny with a clean, fresh scent. Its unique formula allows you to easily restyle your hair throughout the day and washes out with ease. Steadfast Pomade is American-made and veteran-owned. Available in original and anchor hold, get yours today at steadfastpomade.com. Tame the waves and keep it steadfast. This episode is also sponsored by Tiki Tea. Founded in 1961, the Tiki Tea is a family-owned and operated tropical drink bar practicing the lost art of exotic cocktail mixing. Come try their house specialty, the Ray's Mistake, a delicious concoction of botanic liqueurs, passion fruit, gin, and rum for only $6 on Wednesdays until 9 p.m. The Tiki Tea is located at 4427 Sunset Boulevard in Hollywood, California. For more information, check out their website, tiki-ti.com. The Tiki Tea, ground zero for tropical drinks.
Now, I'm enjoying all this history, but at the same time, I want to talk about you and your business.
Right.
So now I know that you, for those that don't know, Jeff is running Latitude 29, one of the greatest bars in the world in New Orleans. I have a bunch of questions for you about that. I'm going to try to keep it concise. Now, you started as a home bartender.
I did.
And so for many years, you were a cocktail historian without a bar.
Yeah, at a time when the word cocktail historian was kind of faintly ridiculous. It's like I never would have, to quote the dude, I never would have self-applied a term like that. I was just a hobbyist. You know, yeah. It was just fun. I was just finding old recipes and trying. And if they were in code, I was trying to figure out how to break the code and how to make them. And it just became sort of like this little detective game. And I was totally a home bartender. I had no intention of opening a bar.
So what was the motivation for that, for opening Latitude 29?
Well, it got to the point where it was just time to stop writing about drinks and start serving them, you know? Mm-hmm. I mean, I just wanted to take it to the next step.
Yeah.
I always told people, including interviewers, like, no, I never want to open a bar. It's too much work. And it is. But what happened was, it was basically Mrs. Beachbum. It was Anine. She kind of dragged me kicking and screaming into it.
Okay.
Unlike me, Anine had had just tons of restaurant bona fides. I mean, from the 1970s in the Lower East Side, she'd been a bouncer, a chef, a sous chef, a host, a bartender. She was a trained bartender. She'd been a server. She had just about every job you could have in the restaurant business, and she was salty. I mean, she hadn't done it since before I met her, but it was all there up in her head.
Mm-hmm.
And she thought, well, why, you know, when the book started to actually become a thing, which I never thought was, I thought I was doing these books for like you, me, Sven Bosco, whoever subscribed to Tiki News back mm-hmm. in the day. I thought maybe like at the most 70, 80, 100 people would be interested in these things. I certainly wasn't doing it to make money, because there was no money in it.
Yeah, back then there wasn't a big audience for it.
We were all just sharing. You
know?
It's the same reason Otto did Tiki News. Let's share all this information we're finding out about all this stuff we love that's just totally mysterious to us. This vanished suburban civilization. But at a certain point, it became, when Tiki took off, after Sip and Safari came out, shortly after Sippin', you had new neo tiki bars serving craft cocktail versions of these, well, basically just serving the drinks, and most of their menu was based on my books.
Mm-hmm.
Recipes I'd found, recipes that had never been published that I found, and in many cases had to decode, and a process that took years, and the only way I could do it was to find some old tiki bartender who could tell me.
That's got to be frustrating, that you do all the legwork behind that, and then, you know.
Well, I was of two minds about it. On one hand, I was thrilled that Tiki was coming back the way it was and that people were doing it right.
Mm-hmm.
But this is awesome, man. I can go into one of these places and have this
proper
drink.
Cocktail, yeah.
Yeah, and it was like, good for all you guys and girls. And then at a certain point, it just became restaurant after restaurant and bar after bar would open, and I'd look at the menu online and it's like all my drinks.
Yeah.
You know, or maybe 40%, 50%, 60%. And it's like, some of these places were winning international awards and making a ton of money and having lines out the door, and I was not making a dime off the books.
Yeah.
I was losing money. I was losing money doing the books. The books were taking me away from stuff that I should have been doing to make money.
Okay.
And at a certain point, Anine said, well, why don't you open a place?
Yeah.
You know how to do the drinks, right? And you've been doing it longer than anyone. Why don't you do it? And of course, it's the dream of all of us who has a home tiki bar mm-hmm. to actually open up a for real one, you know.
Yeah.
I'd had a home tiki bar for like 20 years, and my only qualifications, aside from my knowledge of the recipes, were not having been, I was never a professional bartender. My only qualification was I've been a professional customer for 30 years. And I had over 30 years, you develop pretty strong opinions about what you like and what you don't like when you walk into a bar or a restaurant, what you want to see and what you don't want to see, what you want to drink and what you don't want to drink, and down the line. And that's the experience I took going into it. And that combined with Anine's actual, you know, real restaurant experience, with it, that was the partnership we had bringing this thing to light. And I'm not going to lie, it was like amazing. It was an amazing experience watching it happen, watching it come from just a sort of like a daydream into like a reality was really cool.
Was it what you expected, or did it take you by surprise?
The thing that took me by surprise is I expected a lot more work and a lot more hassle, because I didn't know what I was getting into. But it turns out that there's this little thing called hiring the right people. And that's
what a difference.
That's why we're here, because we managed to find enough of those people and hire them. And I found that a lot of things this was kind of interesting to me. I don't know how interesting it's to anybody listening, but after spending most of my life in the movie business and getting to direct and reading everything I can get my hands on when great directors gave interviews and told how they did it, one of the quotes that really stuck with me was John Huston, you know, the guy who did Maltese Falcon and all those African Queen and all these things. Somebody asked him, well, how do you win all these Oscars? How do you do things like The Asphalt Jungle? And I said, well, it's really simple. Cast well, tell them what you want, and get the fuck out of their way.
Right.
It's like,
right.
And that, I found that that translated perfectly into the service industry.
That works for all businesses. You know, lean on the expertise of the people that you hire. That's why you hire them.
And it was a very quick learning curve. It was like, okay, don't micromanage. Don't tell them how to be. If they're making customers happy, let them be. Like, for example, I've been traveling all over the world. I've been asked by cocktail festivals to come speak about tiki, you know, in all these cocktail capitals of the world, like London, Berlin, you know, all over the place, Rome. And everywhere I went, I would go into the best bars of that city and I'd see how they do it.
Mm-hmm.
And there were certain things that just really impressed me about European-style service behind a bar. And I kind of wanted to do that in New Orleans, just give a really elevated kind of classic experience in a tiki bar with that kind of service. And just like in the movies, when you hire an actor who has their own vision, you just get out of their way and let them do it if it's working.
Yeah.
And what happened was the bartenders who ended up working for us, nobody cared about formal service like that. They wanted a smile and a, hey, how are you doing? How can I help you when you walk in? And then you've got them. And they want an interaction. They want somebody to be friendly, you know.
Mm-hmm.
They don't want some kind of stuck-up craft cocktail, you know, coctologist, you know, lording it over them. They want somebody to give them a good experience and give them a good time and send them away happy. And when I saw, sitting at my garnish station, garnishing drinks, when I saw the way that the bartenders were interacting with the customers, I threw all my shit out the window.
Yeah.
It's like, this isn't needed here. What they're doing on their own, with their own personalities, which you can't teach. There's no training that gives you a cool personality. You either got one or you don't. That's what we've got. And people are happy with the experience they're having with the interaction. It's like, I just step back and let it happen. You know?
Yeah.
And that was liberating. And it was liberating in other ways as well. Like just all the stuff, all the mundane stuff I thought I'd have to spend every waking minute of my day doing, like inventory and cost sheets and accounting and all this stuff. No, you just hire people who can do it.
Just
and they
hire,
do it.
Yeah.
And then I found that it was a lot easier than I thought it was going to be. I had these paranoid visions of 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, trying to keep my head above water, and it never happened. You know? A lot of that was because of Anine. She's pretty much in that position as the GM, but or co-GM, you know, but, with Brad. But we just got, I mean, I love my crew. The crew, I think they're world class. And they're world class in a very specific aloha way. It's aloha bartending.
Right.
I mean, I did one training session where I talked about aloha bartending. It's just like, you know, it's not about the mixology. It's not about anything but just aloha, you know, just making people feel good. And that's really what really drove the day.
I feel like I'm missing out that I'm not, that we're not doing this at Latitude 29, we're doing this here in LA instead.
Well, but the thing is that, you know, we're headed to the Tiki T after
yeah,
this.
There we go, yeah.
Plenty of aloha there, man. You know, you learn from the best. That's now, what the Bruins were all about.
You know, so. The last time you and I sat at a table together was at the Tiki T many years ago, and we talked a little bit about Tony Ramos. And I wanted to bring Tony Ramos up because he doesn't seem to get as much attention or credit as I think he deserves.
Tony Ramos is a perfect example of what we were talking about earlier, the unsung Filipino heroes of the tiki world. Anonymous guys spent their entire careers without anybody ever writing anything about them, anybody ever celebrating them or what they did. But their whole lives were spent making tiki drinks and, you know, doing the thing. And their talents were just, you know, unsung. And Tony, I'll tell you how we found Tony. When I was still doing film advertising, writing trailers, one of my clients, I was freelance at the time, his wife wanted to meet me and Anine at a Chinese restaurant on the west side called Madame Wu's Garden.
Madame Wu's, yeah.
And I'd never been there, but you know, all I knew about it was just another old school Cantonese restaurant that was kind of past its prime.
Right.
You know, in its prime, Cary Grant and Robert Redford and Elizabeth Taylor used to eat there, but I didn't really want. I mean, if in the you know in the 90s, if you wanted Chinese food, nobody wanted Cantonese. You wanted Hunan, you wanted Sichuan, all the hip, cool stuff that was happening. So we kind of reluctantly dragged ourselves over there because that's where the boss wanted to go. And we were early, and we sat in the bar, and that there was this guy behind the bar. It was Tony Ramos, as I found out later, and he handed us cocktail menus, which in itself was very unusual at the time for a bar to have a cocktail menu in the early 90s, Chinese restaurant. And I looked at the menu, and at the time, this would have been the early 90s, I was familiar enough with Don the Beachcomber's menu because I'd been collecting them to know that I was reading a list of Don the Beachcomber's greatest hits in this random Chinese restaurant, like all of Don's drinks, Nui Nui, Rum Barrel, Missionary's Downfall, Beachcomber's Punch. It was all right there.
Yeah.
And I said, excuse me, do you ever work at Tiki Places? And he goes, and Tony started telling me about how he worked for Don the Beachcomber's in Hollywood and Marina Del Rey and Palm Springs, and how he used to serve Navy Grogs to Frank Sinatra, and you know, how Sinatra was a great tipper but the worst customer in the world.
Right.
He just started, you know, telling me this stuff as I was sipping this amazing Planner's Punch he just made for me. And, you know, long story short, we kept coming back, and I started telling all of my tiki pals about it. So Sven Kirsten came the next time, and then Otto von Stroheim came, and then all of their friends came, and we all, that was our hangout, because here was this dude who used to work at Don the Beachcomber's who could make you all of Don the Beachcomber's drinks. Now, he was not going to tell you what was in them.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
But he was making them for you, and it was like a living museum of cocktails.
Yeah, we wouldn't expect him to tell us what's in them, but I remember you saying to me, hey, you know, he's working at Ciudad in downtown L.A., and if you want to get an original Don the Beachcomber cocktail, we could go down there tonight. If he's there, we can order those drinks. That really excited me because this was at a time before you couldn't get a lot of the original drinks. It was a rarity. You could only get some of these drinks at the Tiki Tea and, geez, when Trader Vic's was still in Beverly Hills, I believe.
When it was Trader Vic's.
When it was Trader Vic's, when it was like the way that it's supposed to be. And the one thing that stood out to me was you said, they have no idea who they've got there.
They don't.
They've got them mixing margaritas all day.
Yeah, and they're mixing margaritas and pina coladas. And it was a Cuban restaurant, you know, Ciudad downtown. I don't know if it's still there. But when Madame Wu's folded, that's where he ended up. And they had no idea who it was. They gave him the day shift.
Yeah.
He had the lunch shift. And one of my cocktail buddies who I met through Sven, a guy named Ted Haig, called himself Dr. Cocktail. I took him to meet Tony fairly early on, and he was blown away by Tony. He put Tony's fog cutter in his first book, Vintage Cocktails and Forgotten Spirits. And Ted actually wrote a letter to the management, back when people wrote letters, you know, it was before email, wrote a letter to the management of Ciudad saying, guys, you need to put him on Friday, Saturday night, and you need to let him do the drink menu, because what you have here is, you know, the superstar. I mean, you don't realize. And they just totally blew him off.
Yeah.
Never answered him.
I heard a story from another person that he used to mix his syrups out of the trunk of his car, and he would take them into the bar to make his drinks, and the bar management didn't like him doing that.
Yeah, because technically it's illegal. But you're supposed to do all that stuff literally in-house when it's in
the desert. Right,
right. But
they were secret.
Yeah.
So he
oh, I see. He didn't want them to know.
He didn't want them to know.
Which proves all of
exactly everything
about.
We've been talking about.
Yeah. There you see it in action.
Yeah,
you know,
exactly.
In the late 20th century.
Exactly.
Yeah. He's not going to tell management what was in the syrups.
Right.
And nor should he, the way they treated him. But
where is he today?
Now, well,
he's a friend of yours, right?
Yeah, we became friends over time, which was, you know, he was kind of a reserved guy. And I think we just kind of amused him. Like, he just thought we were all just a bunch of stupid kids. You know, it was like, at a certain point, we were the only people who were ever in Madame Wu's bar. Nobody was ever in that bar. They went to the restaurant to eat. But we sort of colonized that bar when Tony was there. And Otto eventually brought in a boombox with Martin Denny cassettes.
Oh, wow.
So that we could listen to Exotica tunes while we drank Tony's drinks.
Yeah.
And And he just thought, he just...
That's cocktail, tiki cocktail nerdism at its finest right there.
I don't know what Tony thought of us, but he, you know, he was cracking him up probably. And eventually Sven asked him to make drinks at one of Sven's luau's up in his house in Silver
Lake. Oh, wow, okay.
And he did, and he made fog cutters.
Wow,
and,
oh man.
And a couple of other drinks, and a lot of the people there weren't tiki people. They were like Sven's movie friends, and those drinks knocked them on their ass.
Yeah.
Like Sven rented a bamboo bar from Oceanic Arts, which looked really cool, put him on the front lawn. Tony was out there making drinks.
Wow.
And at the end of the day, it was like a scene from Apocalypse Now when the sun rose, all these people passed out on the lawn.
That's hilarious.
So Tony and I got, you know, a little bit closer, and eventually, the last time I saw him, I took him and his wife out to lunch, and that's when he gave me the first recipes he ever gave me, was the last time I saw him.
Uh-huh.
Would have been late 90s, maybe the early aughts, probably early aughts, because I was living in Los Feliz at the time. Went to a little Chinese place on Vermont, and he was moving to Las Vegas, no forwarding address.
Okay.
Like, is there, they might still be out there for all I know, but I have no way of getting in touch with them. The other, before we leave Tony behind, the other thing, Bosco had the Venetian Hotel hire him.
Oh, really?
Yeah, when Bosco did the Taboo Cove, he recommended Tony as, this is the guy you need to train all your bartenders. So they flew him out there and they hired him.
Oh,
to do that.
Okay,
which maybe maybe that's how we got the Vegas bug. I don't know.
Yeah,
he gave me the recipes for the Skull and Bones, which was a beachcomber drink I've always wanted to know what was in, and he gave me the recipe for. That's when he gave me the recipe for the Hawaiian Eye, which is in Intoxico. So this would have been around 2001.
So how hard was it to get those from him? Was this because he was retiring and?
Yeah.
He just thought, you know what, my time is done. Here are the recipes.
Yeah, at that point, he gave me three, you know.
Yeah.
And he just wrote them out on a cocktail napkin for me.
Yeah.
He had given some recipes prior to that to Ted Haig, who shared them with me, because Ted was everything I was not.
Mm-hmm.
Ted was like the boisterous, hey, how you doing, guy? And I was sort of like sitting there sipping my grog. And, too afraid to ask, you know, because I'd been shot down so many times before. But Ted got the Montego Bay from Tony and... which I put in Groglog and a couple of other things. Never Say Die, I think. So he was, you know, eventually, the more he got to know us. And it helped after the Groglog was published.
Yeah.
And that helped with everybody. And that's how I got my first Tiki Tea recipes, was I could show that to Mike and Mike Jr. and say, look, I'm trying to pay homage to you guys. And
preserving them for posterity.
Yeah.
Because I also think about how many great recipes died with their owner.
More than you might think.
Never to be tasted ever again.
There's a guy, Joe Shalom, who I write about in Potions of the Caribbean. At one time, he was the most famous bartender in the world. The guy invented the Suffering Bastard. And he invented, by his daughter's count, 200 recipes. And when she showed me his archives with all of his private papers, I got 30. Mm-hmm. Which still would have been lost to time if she hadn't shown me those. But yeah, so that's 170 original recipes by one of the greatest bartenders of all time who will never... You know, we may never see. Constantino Ribalagua, you know, the cocktail king of the Floridito bar, who taught Trader Vic how to make a daiquiri during Prohibition. Well, not during Prohibition, in the 30s, but during Prohibition, he was the most famous bartender in the world. Constantine, he invented over 150 drinks. Very few of them survive.
Wow.
You know, there's maybe half survive. So somewhere out there, in some family member's, you know, shoebox, there might be the rest of these recipes. We don't know.
Yeah, the guy that kills me. Yeah. Well, you know what? Before we go any further, I want to be respectful of your time. I want to ask you a couple of listener questions.
Sure.
Shall we do that? Okay,
yeah.
So I'm going to pull them up here. So, last week, I posted on the Inside the Desert Oasis Room group page on Facebook that I would be sitting down with you, and I asked people if they had one question that they had for Mr. Jeff Berry, what would that question be?
First of all, nobody calls me Mr. Adrian, you know that.
I just did, so. Okay, well, Jeff Beachbumberry. How many
people only you, Adrian. Only you can call me Mister.
Okay.
Nobody else.
How many people call you Beachbumberry? Is it mostly Beachbumberry or is it mostly Jeff?
I get a lot of Beachbum, which is great, or Bum is great if you're into the whole brevity thing. Again, as the dude said, but one thing that happens a lot. I mean, I've had my name in the papers a little bit, and I've been interviewed about the whole tiki thing since it's become so huge. A lot of people come into Latitude and go, "Hey, Barry, are you Barry?
Are you Barry? Okay."
Yeah. And it's like, "I'm a huge fan. I've read all your books." It's like, "But you didn't read the title page. You skipped that part."
Right, right.
I don't care, though. It's fine. It's like, I never correct anybody. It's right. Just like, you can call me whatever you want.
Yeah. Okay, great. Well, so let me start with this question by Zach Roberts.
I know Zach.
Okay, great. Awesome. Zach's a cool guy. What is on your cocktail bucket list, and or what do you wish you could have tried in the past that is no longer available?
That's a great question. So many things. So many things. I would love to have been able to sit at the bar of the Luau in Beverly Hills in 1953 or Don the Beachcombers in 1937. And just burn through the menu and just see if it's anywhere near what I decoded. Because I could have it all wrong.
Yeah.
You know? I mean, my interpretation of spices number 2 to number 4 might be totally wrong. I mean, I have some evidence to back it up, and eyewitness testimony and all that, but who knows how close to the mark I was. I was basically just reverse engineering the stuff based on what I was being told by some, you know, 80-year-old guys. So I would love to know if I was close.
Yeah.
Even
I haven't even thought about that. You know, going back in time to sit in one of these old bars, I never thought about comparing if it's right or wrong.
Yeah.
To the cocktail recipes that you have in your book, that never crossed my mind.
Because every
I just wanted to experience the place.
Well, because every recipe I've ever gotten has been in bartender shorthand.
Yes.
It's been notes. I mean, they don't give you detailed instructions. For example, none of the Don recipes even mention that you have to flash blend with a certain amount of crushed ice. So every time I got one of these recipes, I would have to bracket the amount of crushed ice I did every time I tried the drink. I would try the drink 8 times and use 8 different amounts of crushed ice each time to see which one gave me the flavor that I liked. Now, the flavor that I like, that I think is best, may not be what Don thought was best.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe he liked his drink sweeter than I think they should have been. Mm-hmm. You know, maybe... maybe I'm off. I had nothing but my own taste to go by. So, yeah, so to go back in time and try those things to compare would be cool.
I'd love to go back with you. Okay, so I have a question by Robert Best. What drink recipe is your white whale?
Another great question. There's several. I mentioned Joe Shalom. The most powerful drink he ever created was for the Havana Hilton Sugar Terrace Bar. It was called the Rocio de Gallo. And he's mentioned it in a couple of interviews in the 1950s. I know it had cream de cassis, guanabana juice, and rum and vodka, and I would love to know what that spec was.
Yeah.
From Don, there are several. In his Hawaiian menus over time, over the years, he had a drink called the Cannibal Grog. I would love to know what's in a Cannibal Grog. There was another one called the Cherry Blossom Punch. There were several others on his menu in Hawaii that were not on any of the little black books that I have because those guys were all domestic. They were all U.S.
Right.
So I'd love to know what Cannibal Grog, just because of the name, got to say.
Yeah, that sounds great.
Yeah.
Okay, a question from John Okanishi. John O.
I know John O.
Yeah, John O. So he's asking, how today's tiki craft cocktail movement compares to your average tiki drink in the 60s. My impression is that in the 30s, the quality was pretty high, but by the time of the 60s, aside from places like the Mai Kai or Trader Vic's, tiki drinks were pretty devolved.
I think John's got the right sentiment, but the wrong decade.
Okay.
If I may, John, I think you're talking about the 70s. By the 70s, everything had gone to shit.
Okay.
Because the industrial food complex had introduced so many prepackaged mixers, you know, sweet and sour mix and pina colada mix and all this. And when the tiki trend finally started to die in the 70s and all of these high overhead, white tablecloth, fine dining tiki places couldn't do it anymore, the places that survived were all the sort of like cheap knockoff places that were not using premium ingredients, that were not using fresh citrus, that were using sweet and sour mix. In the 70s, you have the huge devolution. Now, the 60s, you still had most of these things being done right. the 60s was really, to me, when the cocktails and the decor met at their height.
Mm-hmm.
Because you had hundreds of thousands of dollars being poured into these interiors by people like Steve Crane and Sunny Sund and Don in Hawaii and all these other restaurateurs. They were doing these magnificent Polynesian palaces, Maikai, for example, which hit its peak in the mid-60s. And the drinks and the decor were just like in sync and just like at their highest point. Not long after that, the devolution began.
Right.
But the question that John asked was, how do the drinks, let's just say instead of the 60s, let's amend the question and say, how do the drinks from the 70s compare to what you...
The question was, how do the drinks in today's craft cocktail movement, how do you think they compare to the drinks from the 30s?
Oh, to the 30s? Well,
because he believes that they devolved by the 60s, which you just said you think it's the 70s. And I agree with you, because I do believe that the 60s was the height of the movement.
Well, one of the things you have to remember about craft cocktails now is that the term that's tossed around a lot is Renaissance.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, there was the Dark Ages. We got out of the Dark Ages, and now we're in a Renaissance, a rebirth. And today's craft cocktail bartenders are very scholarly, and they're very conscientious, and they're doing old pre-prohibition drinks, and they're doing tiki drinks the way they were supposed to be done. I think in many places I go, I'm getting impeccable, mm-hmm. just absolutely impeccable renditions of some of these drinks. Not every place. There are other places I won't mention that are still doing cheap knockoff stuff and trying to cash in on a trend,
mm-hmm.
and I hope the trend doesn't jump the shark because of those places. It's the natural arc of a trend, but...
Sure.
You know, the first tiki trend lasted 40 years. If this one lasts 10 in the age of the internet, I'll be happy. You know?
Yeah, yeah. So, okay, I have two more questions. I know that I have more than the questions that I'm asking you, but I'm sorry, everyone, I don't have time to ask all the questions, so I'm going to ask two more. Robert Takata wants to know where you buy your hats. and throw in your cool blazers too in the answer.
The hats, the first ones I got were not easy to come by because it had to be the right kind of looking beachcomber hat, not with some kind of Cuban band around it. It couldn't be a Cuban hat. It couldn't be like that sort of like hipster ass hat kind of thing. It had to be the right kind of thing, and those were really hard to find. I found them in Key West and in South Florida, just in souvenir shops. And they obviously were dead stock. You know, they'd been there forever and they weren't moving. And those were like perfect. But those kind of wore out pretty quick. And mm-hmm. then I was like, well, now what do I do? Turns out in New Orleans, there's a chain of little department stores called Stein Mart.
Yeah, we have Stein Marts out here.
We have Stein Marts here?
Yeah.
Stein Mart had the hat. I was shocked.
Oh, wow.
I went in there looking for like socks or underwear.
But is it a reproduction?
Like,
because the one you had before was dead stock. It had to be a vintage hat.
No, it was newly made.
Okay.
Yeah. In fact,
and that's what's in the bag.
That's this hat. Yeah, and it's the company is called DPC, Dorfman Pacific Company. So maybe they're online. I don't know.
There you go, Robert. Now you know the brand, and you can go look for one if you'd like to have one.
Unfortunately, the blazers are a different matter. The blazers are, many of them were thrift store finds back when you could find those things in thrift stores. That's impossible now. Now you'd have to go on eBay and pay a fortune for them. Some of them I've got at the shopping bazaar at the Hukilau. Mm-hmm. That was always really good. There's this guy, Baseman Kahuna, a.k.a. Dave Wolf, who's sort of like goes all the way around the southeast picking these things. And mm-hmm. he's sold me quite a few great things.
Yeah.
I'm sure that's what I'm going to be gunning for at Oasis, you know, during the shopping bazaar. I want to be the first person to grab whatever those
are. There you go. So now I want to finish with one last question, which I think everybody wants to know. Rich Teske is the person to put this question in the thread, but I think everyone wants to know what your favorite drink is.
The one you just bought me.
The water.
the
one that, yeah, I know
the real,
what you're
saying. The real answer? Man, I mean, I love so many of Don's drinks, but I got to say, the one I keep going back to is the Navy Grog.
Yeah.
It was kind of my first love, and, you know, I've had quite a few variations of it since, but that combination of lime, grapefruit, three different rums, honey, and maybe some allspice, maybe not, even without, it's great. It's just like a fantastic mix.
Yeah.
Really good.
It's a very nicely balanced cocktail.
Yeah, and it's not too sweet. It's just like which is another reason I gravitated toward it, because, you know, yeah, let's talk about the elephant in the room. I mean, a lot of tiki drinks are too sweet. You know?
Yeah, yeah.
Not the great ones. The great ones are all balanced, but there are a lot of sweet ones. Yeah. Some people have a sweet tooth. Yeah.
Well, Jeff, I want to thank you for taking the time to sit down and having lunch with me and answering all my questions and all the historical knowledge that you shared with us.
Oh, my pleasure. You ask good questions.
I think we've jam-packed this episode with all kinds of history, and I hope everybody enjoyed that. Before we sign off, is there anything that you'd like to promote? I think you mentioned that you have a new book coming out.
Yeah, the 10th anniversary edition of Sip and Safari, which, again, talks about all the pre-Tiki Renaissance stuff that happened, like how I met Sven and Otto and Bosco, and how the whole Tiki Central crowd and the Tiki News crowd, and how all that stuff's just kind of formed and happened, and everybody working together uncovered this completely lost knowledge.
Yeah.
You know, like,
yeah.
You go to thrift stores in the 90s and find Tiki mugs and the name of the restaurant beyond it, but you had no idea what this place was, where it was, what this history was. And you go on Tiki Central now, or you go on Tiki News, and you will find your answer because of everybody just sharing all their knowledge, which is cool because nobody shared their knowledge back in the Golden Age because
right.
it was worth money.
Right,
you know?
Right.
It was
right.
Like, but yeah, so the book's coming out. That's the big new thing.
Is there a target date for that?
October.
October,
we're
okay.
And Dan Aguiardo, Tiki Diablo, is coming out with a new Beach Bum Berry mug.
Oh, very nice.
Next, through Cocktail Kingdom. And Bosco is coming out with an amazing Tiki Bum mug that's going to be at Oasis. Like,
I've seen it already because when I recorded the podcast with Bosco, he showed me a bunch of things I wasn't supposed to look at. But
yeah, no, I mean, I'm still laughing when I just.
And I'm talking about mugs.
Yeah,
so.
No, Bosco's. I'm not. I don't have a piece of it. It's not my product, but I just think it's so cool. I have to mention it.
It's very like original, and it's very Bosco.
It's like if you superimpose my face over a Tiki Bob.
Yeah, I wasn't going to say that, but it's a Tiki Bob.
Oh, am I not supposed to say
with your face on it? But yeah, and it looks like the original Beach Bum Berry mug that he made
way
20 years ago.
Yeah,
yeah,
yeah. Which I wish I'd. I wish I hadn't given so many of those away.
I wish I got one. I tried to get one, you know, in the early 2000s. They were impossible to get even.
Well,
we can
try and distract Mike Bowen tonight, and you can reach behind the bar and grab the one.
Oh, yeah,
the
then I could brag about that you, Mr. Jeff Berry,
only you
helped me steal a Beach Bum Berry mug. Well, thank you again for joining the podcast. Let's do a toast. Cheers, mahalo, and aloha.
Ōkole Maluna.
Ōkole Maluna.